Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the organization and David for inviting me. I am indeed honored to have the privilege of coming today to share some of my thoughts about how to make a plant competitive. So thank you. So I'm going to take you on a journey today. I've been doing this for a while, but I'm going to talk about a journey about trying to understand, that's how we started out, trying to understand how does a crop plant actually lose its yield? What are the fundamental mechanisms behind that? And so I'm going to talk about a number of, I'm going to start with the morphology of the plant, and then we're going to get into some of the physiology. And as we enter into the world of physiology, we're also going to enter into the world of communications. How do plants communicate, and how might communication lead to a better understanding of mechanisms? And I'll tell you, it's been an area that gets me pumped and out of bed every morning. So I'm pretty excited about it, and I'm delighted to share that with you. So we heard today there was a symposium on stress tolerance. How do we make plants more stress tolerant? And I think one of the areas for stress tolerance is to try to look at how would we make a plant more competitive against the weed species, okay? And what kind of information do we need to be able to do that? So the idea of a competitive plant has been kind of, in many ways, a holy grail in the weed science community. And there's been a lot of research trying to look at the morphological differences and trying to determine what are the traits that make a plant competitive. The problem is that this data has gone nowhere over the years. You know, they have looked very thoroughly at morphological traits, and sometimes you would think that a tall plant should be more competitive than a small plant. And then in the literature, not all the time that works. They've argued about alleliopathy, and then they've tried density and row width studies to try to confirm that. And really, when you look at those studies, at the end of the day, the results are found to vary with environment and year. And one of my Canadian colleagues, Paul Watson, at the end of the day, did a large test in Western Canada, and at the end of the day of this huge amount of work, came up with, I think, captures the problem, that the correlation coefficients simply were not strong enough to attempt reliable co-selection with a breeding program. Just not consistent, and the correlations were not strong enough. You'd think it would be common sense that we should be able to design a plant that's competitive, just thinking it through. Doesn't work that way. It appears to be more complicated. So I'm going to present two arguments about intraspecific competition and intraspecific competition. So we start to look at what do we know about competitive ability. And this is a classic response on maize throughout the years. And one of the things that you do notice is this continued increase in yield and since the hybrid technology being introduced. And there are generally thought to be two reasons for this. One is the newer hybrids were more stress tolerant. And secondly, that these hybrids during the reproductive phase continued to accumulate plant dry matter, which is directly related to kernel number and kernel weight. So there are two variables there that attributed to that. This is an example of work we did with Tice Tolliner back a number of years ago now. But what we did, we took a look at this Pride 5 here is a very old hybrid used in Ontario, and we compared that to the leading pioneer product at the time, 3902. And I'm showing you the selected data here, but this is harvest index under low nitrogen, high weed pressure. This is yield under low nitrogen, high weed pressure. And just to show you the worst-case scenario, and what is interesting is if we look at harvest index, which you would hope would be around 0.5, like 50% or so, this one maintained a harvest index, and you can see it declined, particularly in the old one. And it also, of the yield, it was still one of the top yielders. And it would argue then that our assumption was that, you know, your top-yielding hybrids are your top-yielding hybrids both in good conditions and in bad conditions, okay? That's kind of a simple rule that I think still applies today. So we know that there are differences and that the new technology has improved the competitiveness. This curve was fundamental in our thinking. So this is the critical period work. Early on, I did a lot of work with critical periods. And a critical period is a study designed to test what point in the life cycle of a plant is it most susceptible to weed pressure. And I want to draw your attention to this line here. So this basically says the longer the weeds are present, the greater the yield loss. Well, that's pretty standard stuff. But what is interesting And this is where it started to get complicated for us, is we realized that we started to lose yield very quickly at the seedling stage. Okay? So, for example, if I'm in this part here, according to our mathematics, we would have lost a certain amount of yield. That yield was lost very, very quickly. And even if we had 95% of the growth cycle back still ahead of it, it never retrieved that lost yield. So how's that possible? How could that be that you could lose yield? In fact, we estimate in some crops that you'd lose 2 bushels or half a bushel a day. Okay, and yield potential was lost, and it never came back. That plant was on a totally different trajectory for growth and yield. So that meant that something had to be changing rapidly in the seedling, at the seedling stage. And because we would argue that at those early stages, if you've done your agronomy right, the crop is ahead of the weeds. Okay, so there's no competition for light. Okay, we've just put tons of fertilizer on. Hard to argue that there's a nutrient shortage, okay? Because we normally assume weeds are going to be competing for light, water, and nutrients. I'm going to tell you that that does happen, but a whole lot happens prior to that. So if it's not light and it's not nutrients, and most times we plant to water, unless we have a drought going on, and if you look for water studies, that's a hard thing to show, okay, in the literature. So what else could it be? And that's kind of what led us along this path a bit. We also know, and I've lost my axes here, I apologize for that, but somehow that disappeared. But we also did threshold studies. And so this is a pigweed, red and green pigweed, that emerged at 3-leaf corn versus 7-leaf tip. So this is leaf tip. So that's like 3-leaf tip would be like 1 to 2 fully expanded leaves. Okay, keep this in mind. So these are leaf tips. And the corn yield loss, look how rapidly it is at 3. But 4 leaf tips later, you have a totally different response to the presence of weeds. What happened between 3 and 4 and 7 to change the dynamics of the competitive ability to such a degree? And this is grass. This is barnyard grass. And so here, barnyard grass that emerges at the first leaf, up to maybe a 20% yield loss. But look at the densities here. This is lawn. This is a lawn underneath that corn plant. And then if it emerged at the fourth leaf tip, we didn't have any yield loss from that whatsoever. So again, you see the dynamics of competition shifted with the growth stage dependent upon when the weeds emerged with the crop. So what did we learn from some of those studies? That we discovered that new maize hybrids are more tolerant to weeds, and the yield loss was driven by the time of weed emergence, and broadleaf weed competition differed dramatically from grass competition. In further studies, we discovered at the whole plant level, we could get a delay in rate of leaf appearance and a reduction of fraction in intercepted photosynthetic active radiation, and that we could get a reduction in plant dry matter during the ASI period, the anthesis silking interval. And that's critical. Weeds can cause this reduction in plant dry matter at the whole plant level. And what I want to show you here is just how the presence of weeds, and I'm going to come back to speed of change, and it's irreversible. Okay? This is a corn with some colleagues at Colorado. So they were testing some of the things that we're saying. And so we worked with them on this particular study. And so this is harvest index and total dry matter per plant base, the frequency of total plant dry matter. So when I spend $300 for a unit of corn, I want something, I'm expecting all those plants to be the same, okay? Same harvest index, same plant dry weight and stuff. So here's an example. So up here is harvest index, and this is the frequency distribution. I want you to watch how the community dynamics change in the presence of a weed, okay, when there are weeds in the corn crop. So this is weed control at the first leaf tip. Okay, so that's just the plants just out of the ground. And again, I'm going to select some time. We had a series of time studies here, but I'm just going to highlight. This is 5-leaf tip. This is like 3 expanded leaves. Now, let's go back, take a look at that. And 4-leaf tips difference. We have changed the entire distribution of the plant dry matter in that corn crop. Now, that corn crop is still going to look like a field of corn. You don't see this happening, but the entire distribution has changed. Our harvest index has now started to expand, and we're starting to have some reduction in our harvest index. And if we played that out, and we have a yield difference of 70, we obtained 72% of the weed-free check. And if I took that to the weeds were present for the whole season, notice how it's all shifted to the left here, to the axis here, and we now have barren plants. This drop here represents barren plants, where the total dry matter has got to such a low level that the plant actually collapses during the silking and thesis period. Okay? So you can see these rapid changes. So we could do this in time sequence, and you could see that whole plant community changing, all based on the timing in which we control the weed species. So this gives us an idea of where yield loss is coming from. And I want to highlight how the frequency, the plant dry matter frequency on a per plant basis is changing. So that has a dramatic impact on the anthesis silking interval. And so just to bring everybody up, this is the length of time between pollen shed and the silk emergence. And its ASI, the length of the ASI is really a window into the stress that a corn plant has been under. Okay, the more stress, the longer that ASI period can be. So we're talking about pollen shed here to reception here by the silk. So this value can be negative or positive because it depends on which comes out first, the silk or the tassel, usually the tassel followed by the silk. We know that silk emergence is most sensitive to stress. And we also know, this is key, that plant growth rate, or the ability to put on plant dry matter during the reproductive period. And that's one of the things I mentioned about why we have more stress-tolerant plants, is critical to kernel number. Okay, there's a direct relationship between plant growth rate and kernel number at the time of anthesis. So this is an example here of some of our data with a pioneer variety again. This is kernel number, plant growth rate. And what's interesting, if any of these stresses have altered the plant growth rate, like you have closed down, you've changed rate of leaf appearance, okay? You've changed the allometry of the plant. These things can have a dramatic impact on growth rate. And as growth rate gets declines during the anthesis period, look how kernel number drops dramatically. You put a curve through there and calculate on a per minute basis the yield loss in kernel number. You can do things like that and come up with some pretty dramatic numbers. So this is some from the literature, again, looking at grain yield and length of ASI. And this is work done with temperate corn, and this is work done with tropical hybrids. Okay. What again, so as we increase ASI, this is degree days, and this is done in days over here. But here, with the temperate work, and notice the shape of this curve, notice how dramatically grain yield declines with increase in ASI. With increase in ASI, it's driven by stress. Okay? We see the same relationship, and even more dramatic under the tropical conditions, you can see that. And we did a study to see what would happen with our own Canadian hybrids, and we saw the same type of relationship. So this is if we're weed-free up here, if we're weedy to the 10th leaf, it's the triangle, these guys here. But if we let it stay all season, you could see we got the same type of curve. So dramatic changes in ASI. ASI was one of the criteria which they selected when they were looking for drought tolerance or stress tolerance. They looked for lines that had the shortest ASI under stress. It was one of the first ways they started to look for drought tolerance in corn. So I'm coming back to the aspect of speed of loss caused by weeds. So we estimated, this is estimated yield loss in these studies. And at 7 hours, if we increased the ASI period by 3.5 growing degree days, caused a delay of 7 hours, 14, or 21. In this study, based on that curve, you lost 15, 26, and 36. The temperate ones lost 5, 10, and 14. This is at the time of reproduction. Right? Again, dramatic. Look how fast it changes. Look at the degree to which it changes. And with in the presence of weeds, look at how our numbers compare to these as well. So it's by the moment. It's by the minute. You can talk about yield loss by the minute if you wish, because it's real. So what do we know at this point then about stress and about weed stress and other environmental stresses? And I want to show you this is kernel number versus plant growth rate. Remember that these two are directly correlated. So this is the way we think things actually happen. So if you have no stress, you get a decent growth rate out here, and you should have a decent yield, a kernel number per plant. But if we start to get a little bit of weeds, we delay controlling our weeds, we start to shift that whole population down this curve, okay? We start to drop the yield potential very quickly, and then if we throw in a little bit of drought on top of that, and weeds plus drought, you can see that this changes dramatically, and we get a whole pile of barren plants. It's kind of, I call it the Niagara Falls effect. Okay, like we're rowing down that river, and eventually under stress, we're going to go over the top in that barrel and land at the bottom of Niagara Falls. So that curve is fairly dramatic, fairly rapid, and you can see that it's irreversible. Right? It doesn't come back. So that changes the way in crop physiology we talk about yield potential and growth, because normally we would think about this nice smooth curve like this in a non-stress environment. We put on biomass, we should have yield potential. But what I'm saying is that that's not the way it happens. It's like a stairway impact, okay? So our plant, I spend $300 a unit for corn or more, and that's okay. I'm on my growth trajectory until the first stress comes along. And when I hit that first stress, it's like, well, this stairs over here. I took a step over here because of that stress. Now I'm on a totally different growth trajectory. I can't get back over to that step. I'm over here now. And every time that happens then, I start to, every stress I experience through the summer results in that final yield differential between what I was promised by the pioneers and DeKalb's and the pride of the world and what I actually ended up in that field, because it's cumulative. Okay? So every time I step on that stress, I change, and you saw that illustrated in that previous diagram. So that's where we think that we, how we understand that this plays out. And your yield potential changes with each one of those things. So the question is, how do I keep on that optimum growth trajectory as long as possible? Okay? Because at the end of the day, the stress can be so severe no matter what technology we have, it's going to take it down. So the goal then becomes is, can I keep my plants on a trajectory as long as possible? What does it happen to do? So if I think about competition as a variable of nutrients, limited nutrients, it does not explain what happens at those early seedling levels. It can't. It doesn't make sense. So then we asked ourselves, is it possible that those plants actually communicate? Is it possible that they actually know that a weed is present? Okay. And it's incredible, absolutely amazing what has we pulled out of here. So this is really where the questions we ask. So does that corn plant, and I'll tell you right now, just to take the suspense out of the air, that spike right there knows that that plant's right there. Okay? It knows it's there. Because it's changing its physiology. It's changing its physiology by the minute. Okay? Can we detect? Can we adjust? Can we communicate? And can we recognize another corn plant? Okay? Fundamental questions. And if we ask those questions, do we get some insights into the actual early mechanisms of plant competition? So what we're dealing with here is really called the shade avoidance syndrome. So we're getting far red reflected off the surface of a leaf, detected by the phytochrome in a corn plant or a soybean plant. And when that detection occurs in the phytochrome, this begins to trigger a series of molecular and physiological changes in a plant that have dramatic impacts on yield potential. I'll show you some of the things we do. So how do we do this? So we worked through several designs, but very simply, what we did is, so this is a far red dense, we call it density here, far red, So this is far red where we grow, if you think of a donut on the outside, we've got grass growing there. We put the plant in here, and here's our weed control. There's no competition there. So we separate, so there's lots of water, lots of light, lots of nutrients. They are fed separately. They are fed independently. They drain independently through those pots. So all we're talking about is this grass over here sending a signal to this soybean plant or to this corn plant, and then we take a look at what happens inside the soybean plant or corn plant. In our far red, you can see the differences in the far red. So very simply put, it's almost magical, right? You have a pot, which is a corn plant. you have a weed in a pot, nothing in between, nothing up my sleeves, nothing's happening. This one's being fed all the nutrients in the world. I pull up a weed alongside it, and I begin to change rate of leaf appearance. I alter the carbon allocation in that plant. I alter the shoot-to-root ratios. I can shut down, suppress photosynthesis, and I can cause an explosion of free radicals in the plant. All of that happened because I had a chat with a weed species, okay? Nobody touched anything. Nobody reached out and touched. Nothing other than I had communication. Those things are all published in responses to what's happening inside. The other interesting thing, this is now a published paper in Weed Research, but at this stage here, my previous graduate student looked at how soon does a plant pick up the signal. Is it possible that as the seedling is coming through the ground, that it begins to read the above ground information? Okay? You have to think about these plants as chipboards, computer chipboards, okay? What we found here, so we grew in that same pot, so that we had the weeds growing, but not touching, and the soybean plant coming up independently in the center, but no contact of roots or leaves or shading. And this VE1 is the hypocotyl stage. What his data showed, and we had him repeat and repeat to be sure we're right, by the hypocotyl arch stage of a soybean plant, that means it had read the last little few centimeters of the soil, picked up between the pores some of the signaling that's above ground, it had changed its root-to-shoot ratio. You got to pause and think about that. Before the seedling was out of the ground, it was already changing its carbon allocation because it's starting to pick up the signal that there's green tissue above. And so as when it emerged in there, it says, no, the cotyledons aren't even out of the ground, and the plant had already changed. How fast is that? Okay, because you've got to send a signal in molecular. Molecular has to respond to the physiology. Physiology has to run down so many cycles to make these things happen. And that happened within the last couple centimeters of the soil surface. Unbelievable. And we also triggered anything above that line. We actually triggered some of the antioxidant genes that got pumped up because we're getting expression of free radicals. You'll find that, I think that a lot of our stress responses, the plants have a common toolbox. One of the things that's pretty common across all of the stresses happening both abiotic and biotic is the explosion of free radicals in the plant and the upregulating of antioxidant genes. So what did we learn? We learned that corn and soybean seedlings can detect the above ground prior to emergence, prior to coming out of the ground, okay? So weed and crop communication creates, but this is what we're going to argue, an imbalance in energy, okay? An imbalance in energy that occurs in photosystem 2. We have some work coming out to show this. And this imbalance of energy is driven by the fact that a weed will trigger singlet oxygen expression as the initial start in a plant. You'll actually get singlet oxygen, and singlet oxygen causes a series of events that affect the plant. So we think that weeds don't initially compete for light, water, and nutrients. The presence of weeds changes the energy imbalance in a cell. Now, let me show you something you've never seen. I'm pretty sure you haven't seen before. I'm going to show you that through plant communication, a weed can kill a crop plant. No touching. Nothing between them. Lots of light, water, and nutrients, and through the power of communication, I almost sound like a Baptist minister here, but through the power of communication, that the weed will actually kill this plant, okay? So what we did, so on your left, right, left, that's bad. Oh, there it is. Whew. All right. Sorry. So here's our weed tree. Here's our weedy. This is a tobacco plant, regular tobacco plant. We created by using, we blocked AOX, okay, antioxidant gene. And we just temporarily did that with a product called SHAM. So we basically created a stress which causes an increase in free radicals. And I want you to watch these plants here. Okay, so this is the control. This one has stress. So they start out with the same level of stress. Watch what happens to the plant on the left. This plant is dead. Run through that again, because this is unbelievable. What we did was create an energy imbalance, and then we allowed a communication to occur. That communication put that imbalance at such a level that the plant could no longer quench it, and as a result, the free radicals began to be dangerous and toxic to the plant. And all of that occurred simply by communication. Never before noticed, not in biological systems. So it shows that there's some proof behind this idea of an energy imbalance. And this energy imbalance occurs in the photosystem system, and it occurs simply by communication, simply being able to detect that there's a weed there, and it causes me to get stressed out, right? And I can't quench this. And this imbalance creates cellular, disrupts homeostasis in the cell. So, in terms of interspecific, so knowing this then, and we start to understand some of the flow of the physiological changes, then the idea is, well, maybe a breeder can start to look at some overexpression of some of these genes. Maybe there are ways that we can make that plant more tolerant to weeds, and if that's true, how cool would that be? Because this is a consistent problem out there, right? We might be able to change the tolerance over time. So, this is what we think real competition's about. We think that this imbalance, the plant has to deal with that. It has to deal with the damage that's occurred, and that costs energy, and that extra energy that's meant to repair all that system, that's your loss of yield potential. That's what we think is happening. Okay? The more I have to expand to recover from my sickness, the less strong I am to protect my yield potential. Okay, that's the thought process to account for some of those things. Firelight triggers the production. We think that singlet oxygen... We're about to take these pictures. We're confident that it is now singlet oxygen that is the initial trigger of this imbalance, and it's singlet oxygen then that just triggers a sequence of events that the plant can't handle. And the cost of this recovery is really about that rapid yield loss that we talked about. So then that brings up the second question, right? So if that's what happens when a plant sees a weed, okay, what is the difference between inter- and intraspecific competition? What happens when a corn sees a corn or a soybean sees a soybean? Do we see the same types of things? But first, I want to start with morphology. So what do we know about intraspecific competition? In corn, we know that intraspecific competition can create a hierarchy. It can increase plant-to-plant variability. It can challenge for light competition, and intraspecific competition can alter photosynthetic rates. We've done all these studies. We know that plant growth rate decreases. We can delay that anthesis silking interval, and I showed you that if we delay that, we're going to be in real problems, and that will affect kernel number and increase plant barrenness in a plant. Those are going to happen. So that's at the morphology level. Then the question says, okay, and that happens usually, like our measurements are at later in the season, around the 12th to 14th leaf stage. And so those impacts are a function of density. And the more dense your stand is, the sooner that intraspecific competition begins to affect the growth of the corn plants. But then the other question is, so what happens if a soybean sees a soybean? Does it know that it's different? Okay? And we just submitted a paper that says, you bet. It can tell the difference between a self and non-self. That's called kin recognition. There's a growing body in the ecological literature that suggests that there is some evidence of kin recognition. That is, they know the difference and they won't be as competitive. But this whole concept of altruism in a plant, that is to say, if you're my sibling, I'm not going to compete as dramatically with you. I'm going to try to avoid. So it kind of counters the whole idea we were taught about you share the same niche, that should be the most intense competition. That might not be true, if this is true. Okay? So you might have a field of soybean or a field of corn, and these guys are all acting altruistic to each other. They're trying to find a different niche somehow so that they're not competing directly as aggressively with my neighbors as I might with another plant. And the question is, what is the mechanism? How does that differ between recognizing and we? So, I mean, I'm as skeptical about this as anybody, but I have to say we did a number of lots of reps, and we did the stats right, and I had that double-checked. And so what I want to show you here is just some of the data. This is soybean response to a different species. So we put a soybean, and then we put different species growing next to it, okay? So this is a soybean plant here, glycine max. This is leaf allocation, carbon allocation. So we did our measurements to account for difference in sizes and stuff. But this is soybean growing with soybean. We had 14 different cultivars of soybean. And what I want to show you here is that leaf allocation did not change when soybean meant soybean, okay? Here, when you put a white beans, Phaseolus vulgaris, next to a soybean plant, you change the allocation pattern, okay? It grew differently when there was a white bean plant growing beside it. And then we did the same thing with the ancestral species, glycine soja, which is the ancestral species, the original soybean plant from which we've developed our current soybean lines. And it grew differently again in the presence of the ancestral soybean plant, okay? So we've done the stats, and at the end of the day, the growth is different. Okay? It allocates differently depending on who its neighbor is. So this whole thing, and I mean, this just really baffled me, but right now we think that the soybean plant, we're doing it on corn now coming up, and we think that a soybean plant has that ability. Okay? Because you know when a soybean, if you look at a soybean row, you don't see the typical shade avoidance of long, thin stems and limited roots. You know that there's a difference in the growth pattern. And this is consistent, okay? So identity recognition at ancestral level and at the species level. So could recognize species, knew that there was a different ancestral species there. And this would agree with current selection theory in the ecological literature. So kin recognition may be a fundamental mechanism explaining intra-specific competition. And that may have an impact, if we understand that, about densities and planting patterns. Now, totally by chance, I got involved in seed treatments because I wanted to know, certain seed treatments were suggested that they were enhancing growth of a seedling. And so we went to Syngenta and asked them if we could test their seed treatment. We said, do you know why you get seedling vigor? They said, no, we know that we do, but we don't know how. And we said, well, we have some ideas. So we went to test this, okay? So seed treatments. So now I move to a different concept here, but can seed treatments help us with stress tolerance? Studies show that the neonicotinoid insecticide treatments can enhance stress tolerance to weeds by upregulating antioxidant genes and genes involved in soybean nodulation. I want to show you that. I want you, at the end of the day, soybean seed treatments, I want you to begin to think about seed treatments way beyond the concept of crop protection. Can we actually use seed treatment chemistry to enhance stress tolerance beyond crop competition? This is the photograph that just blew us out of the water. So what I want to show you, so the darker the leaves, the more free radicals. This is a stain for for hydrogen peroxide. We know, so here's untreated, weed-free, and you can see where we cut it off the stem, and you see, because there's always free radicals in the leaf, okay? We know that if we grow a corn plant in the presence of weeds, you get an explosion of hydrogen peroxide, free radicals, singlet oxygen, okay? See the dark leaves, right? Then we treated with, this is thiamethoxin, which is a neonicotinoid. And we treated it here, weed-free, and you can see it's very similar here. But look at this. This is treated in the presence of weeds. Look at the difference between here and here. It actually upregulated. The seed treatment upregulated the antioxidant genes so that it was able to quench the free radical expression prior to any onset of injury. So probably we said, we had to repeat that several times. We said, that can't be right. And we went back and back and back and did it five times, took five of these pictures before I was willing to accept that that was happening. So it changed everything. And it changed, and so the shade avoidance, it actually prevented Let me back up. If you put a soybean plant or a corn plant in front of the weed, you get shade avoidance, so it starts to grow long, no roots. Treat it with a thymethoxin insecticide, you negated that whole impact. The weed was there, the plant grew normally. The allometry was not changed in the presence of a weed, provided I had the seed treatment on the seed, and this is evidence how the physiology was protected. We then did that with soybeans. This paper's just been published, where we looked at treating soybeans. So here's nodule number, and I want to point out nodule number and nodules per root. But here's untreated weed-free. We know that in the presence of a weed will knock down nodulation in a soybean plant. Okay, you'll get much less nodulation. Look at here. When we treated it, we did not get any difference. We protected nodulation of the soybean plant in the presence. When the crop was able to see a weed, we still protected it by the treatment with thymethoxin. And if you calculated the nodules per gram of root dry weight, we saw the same type of thing. Notice here, doesn't change it. Okay, dramatic difference. And we didn't get any of the other growth changes. We protected the roots. We protected the stem. We basically protected, allometry in the plant. All of that because of seed treatment. Very cool. Very, very cool. So, what do we know in conclusions? We know that if we're going to breed for weed competitiveness, it's going to involve redefining seedling competition. And you need to think about the seedling competition, which is when the yield potential is changing dramatically, really as the basis of that is this imbalance in energy. Excuse me. We think that understanding the mechanisms of plant communication should help us elicit some of these pathways, which we hope then that breeders can use and help us to advance, and that we can understand these differences between intra and intra-specific competition. How do we maintain cellular redox homeostasis by restricting the negative impacts of ROS? Whether it's heat stress, cold stress, nutrient stress, ROS is always present. Okay? ROS is present in the cell. It acts as a signal, but it gets over a threshold and we get into trouble, a bit like alcohol, right? You can have a glass of wine, it's all cool. You drink the bottle, we're into trouble, right? Same type of concept. So how do we maintain stability of homeostasis under stress? How do we protect the ASI period? And finally, the discovery of novel seed treatments, I think, can play a very important role in the future for stress tolerance in crop plants. With that, I want to thank you for being on a journey with me. That's where we're at in the present moment. I hope you enjoyed the presentation. Thanks. No, haven't. I know that there's a lot of interest in the microbial populations and how that influences root growth. Yeah, no, we got into that game quite by chance, but I think there's room for those types of studies. So how does, I think that's the key, right? How does some of those microbial benefit? Because you see differences in roots, right, with some of these treatments. And will that hold under stress? That's a fundamental question. Fair. So PPFD is helpful. So when you look at a study and they talk about the change light, there are two components you have to talk about, right? You have to talk about PPFD and you have to talk about light quality. So in our work, we hold PPFD constant. We prevent any shading of the crop plant itself. Our symptomology is the symptomology of shade avoidance. The other variables that could be floating around are things like ethylene, blue light, those types of things. We've been challenged by those, but in our chamber we have good airflow going straight up. We don't clip the grass when we're into the studies. And when you look at the ethylene studies in particular, ethylene becomes an issue when a canopy encloses and becomes fairly dense, or they've actually waved fairly high concentrations of ethylene across the seedling itself. So we recognize that those things are in the game a bit, but we believe that by far the major impact is the light quality and the signaling from red to far red. Hard to detect all those things. We've designed a system where we can do that, to knock out all those other things, but we're pretty comfortable with the thought that it's primarily driven by far red. Yep, behind you. I think it provides the science behind the critical period. I think the critical period is still real and still useful. And this provides sort of the science to explain why we're seeing early yield losses in those critical period studies. In terms of practical management, probably, you know, the whole idea of start clean and stay clean is important, Bill. But I think it provides the science behind it at the end of the day. Very limited. We have screened, in terms of the shade avoidance, we have screened several different cultivars or hybrids, and we've selected ones that clearly show a response. Okay. The general thought there is that most of them show it, but to varying degrees. So there is some variability in the germplasm to this signaling. No, nothing. Yep. Just strictly, no. Just what you saw. That's as basically as much as we've done. We, you know, we keep struggling for money to keep going. So, yeah. Let me go over here. This lady here in the back, sorry, in the red. Right, like the three sisters and things like that. Mm-hmm. Also cover crops. I think this, the fact that depending on the soil type and the pore structure in the soil, the fact that we have evidence, and we have the evidence both on corn and on soybeans that they're able to detect as they come through the ground. Okay. So a lot of questions I get is around cover crops at the moment, because cover crops are the flavor of the week. And how do you manage a cover crop in light of this, right? So what we're suggesting is that the cover crop should either be planted with the concept of the critical period where we get past those early stages and you introduce the cover crop, or if the cover crop is on the ground when you plant, you want to be sure that it's not living when those seeds come out. So you need to have either a rapid burn down or you wait until the tissue's down. So our data would suggest that if your crop comes up into a green cover crop, you're going to have explosions of free radicals and actually impact on yield. In terms of intercropping, like the three sisters and things like that, you know, those systems work because they stage them at different times in the cropping. So everything's dependent. As you saw how the susceptibility of a corn plant varied with when the weeds came up. So with that kind of knowledge, you can intersperse different crops, given the fact that you have given the initial crop time to establish and on its way, and then introduce the next one. Everything depends on the relative time of emergence to each other. So you'd have to think about that before in your study. I saw a study on perennial ground cover today, and the guy was talking about all his yield losses, and man, we would have predicted that before he even started. No. Yes. Drains separately too.
And the material that's
That's right. It's a ryegrass growing around. It's a turf species that's growing on the inside. Yeah.
So there's no chance of confusion.
No, not that way. You know, the only real thing there could be some ethylene emitted from the leaf tissue to some degree, and that's why we don't cut. We trim everything prior to the beginnings of the experiment. And in the literature, the ethylene really plays a role much later in canopy structure and things like that. And at the end of the day, too, we also feel if it was ethylene, we're circulating in a growth cabinet, it would be affecting our control plants as well, because we have a barrier so that there's no transmission of light. But I don't think so. We're pretty confident that, you know, you can never eliminate everything, but that's where we're at. Oh, you're talking about different emergence of the crop?
Yeah,
that's interesting. You know, the bottom line, when there's corn or soybeans, when a corn plant comes up, it should only see another corn plant. But we do know that if you get uneven emergence, then the later emerging one, you know, can suffer because of competition and potentially become barren. Undoubtedly, there's signaling that's happening, but I don't know to what extent. Okay, I think probably that's you know, that's intra-specific competition when it comes up later. Not sure I answered your question well, but do you want to try it again?
No, I mean that answers
probably. Yeah, that's just where we're at with it.
Not specifically going and doing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's been a lot of work on variability and how variability influences the stand. And usually we think about, you know, if a plant in a stand falls 2 to 3 leaves behind the rest of it, that plant will become barren. And that's likely because of intraspecific competition that prevents plant dry matter to accumulate at the time of reproduction. I'm pretty sure it triggers the antioxidant genes. So think about that, right? If I could put some chemistry on there that would be triggered when when free radicals got above a certain threshold, right? Or have that chemistry circulating in a plant that somehow would be triggered by the signal itself. At the very least, it would keep the plant on its optimum trajectory a little bit longer. You know, how long is that? We don't know. If the next stress comes along, it shifts it on the stairway again, right? But we're pretty sure that this will stimulate increased antioxidant activity. Yes? Well, we just used one. We used thymethoxin. And in Ontario, the government has outlawed, because of the bee issue, it's outlawed the use of neonicotinoids. And we have to go through a huge amount of paperwork to be able to buy seed with it. Unfortunately, I don't think the company can talk about these benefits, because in the literature, the neonicotinoids also protect against drought tolerance, enhance drought tolerance. There are a lot of benefits to this chemistry that go well beyond the issue of crop protection. Very, very interesting. Oh, it could be, yeah.
And another question.
Possible.
Soybean being able to tell the salt coming from another, and it sounds like if they let it hear the full talk, sorry. Sounds like it's a diacron, red, far red, black ratio difference. How is that ratio difference?
Right, exactly. Because up until this kinship hitter, you know, hit me in the frontal lobotomy I had on that, I would always argue this is green tissue on green tissue, right? Then you went, well, that can't be right, because it's got to be a different signal. Right now in the literature, the mechanism of kinship recognition is debatable. The traditional view is that it's root exudates that it recognizes. That's the traditional view. But it's got to be more complicated than that, because it sees the plant. So there's a recent paper that talks about phytochrome involvement in this process. And that was a paper by Kazel. So it's possible, I think, so my thought right now is that phytochrome recognizes it. There must be a different pathway, like something's different, and that recognition influences the, you know, the quality or the ratio of root exudates, and then the message gets picked up by the root. So bottom line, I don't know. We have a lot of speculation around it, but it's certainly not solved in the literature. Well, there you go. More to come. Right. Thank you very much, people. Everyone.